Thanks very much, Laura and Alex, for inviting me along. It's a great pleasure to be here. I was born in Yorkshire, actually, a long time ago, in Hull, when it used to be part of Yorkshire. So it's nice to be back in my home county. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is using a historical perspective on births in relation specifically to collective provision of welfare. I think it's one of the sort of strongest general myths that welfare states are a product of the mid-20th century across Western Europe, that they are a kind of they are a luxury item that rich societies can afford when they get developed and when they become democratic. And of course, in the last 10 or 15 years, and particularly the last few years, this welfare state and its the centre of it, what we call the NHS, has been under quite a lot of pressure. And there are people in government, people in the coalition and their advisers who would even probably view the welfare state and the NHS as some kind of option that in an ideal free market world would be done without. I think that a proper grasp of the history of Britain shows that a welfare system has been absolutely fundamental to this country's history for 500 years, not for 75 years, and that undoubtedly it is an integral part of why this part of the globe became precociously developed. It's not a luxury consequence of industrialization. It was actually an integral part of how this part of the country achieved very high levels of human capital, security of food supply, and freedom from the worst aspects of mortality, all of which were very conducive towards economic growth and development. So I also think that which I'm going to focus on today because you're the focus of your conference, that there is quite a strong case to put that this long-term history of welfare provision, which has certainly had its fluctuations over time, one of the reasons why it's kind of the early modern welfare state has disappeared from view is it was called the Poor Law, the Elizabethan Poor Law, and in collective memory, the Poor Law is something which most people know through the novels of Charles Dickens, and that the Poor Law has gone into folk memory as something that was the enemy of the poor, that was a draconian system. It's associated with the word workhouse, and the Poor Law has a extremely bad name in popular memory and indeed in modern 19th century Victorian history. But there was a Poor Law in existence for a quarter of a millennium before the Victorian Poor Law, which is the one that I'm going to talk a bit about today, which was a very different animal and was certainly the friend of the poor and was an extremely important institution with intriguing consequences for the whole population. And I'll be focusing particularly on its relationship with fertility, but I think we could also, I may say something about mortality as well along the way. Good. So, this is what the unbroken line at the top is what I'm really talking about here. It's a nice, helpful graphic description of the TFR, the total fertility rate of the population of England over the 500 years that we're talking about, 450 years that we're talking about. And as you can see, it's an interesting line. It has different phases and moments in it. It's by no means a straightforward story that we're interested in here. The line along the bottom, by the way, the dotted line is expectation of life at birth, which is the best single measure of mortality in the population. And as you can see, the expectation of life at birth sort of fluctuates around between 35 and 40 years for most of the first 250 years of the period. All the action in terms of Britain's population change is really being driven by big changes in the TFR, in the fertility rate. First of all, falling, then rising to a real peak, then falling again and then rallying a little bit in the mid-19th century, and then a plummetous fall down to a nadir in the 20th century. But then, right at the very end, an interesting rise again in the mid to late 20th century. So what I'm going to be looking at is that TFR and its different phases. And what I would say is it's got maybe as many as 7 different phases there that we're looking at. A decline between 1540 and 1640, that first period there at the beginning on the left. Then a rise, quite a long sustained rise from 1660 through to 1821, which is that peak just before the first dotted line on the vertical axis. Then a fall from 1821 to 1851, a definite fall back from that peak. And then a rally for a similar amount of period, a similar period of 25 years or so in the second quarter of the 19th century. And then a steep fall from 1876 down to 1946, followed by again a rise, or more than a rally, an actual rise. People were familiar with the term baby boom. The baby boom, you know, sort of suggests something that happened briefly after the war when everybody came rushing home and everybody was in a joyful mood and produced lots of babies in 1945 and 46 and 47. And people think that's the baby boom. But the baby boom, the post-war baby boom, is a 25-year period of much higher fertility than the 1930s and the 20s. It's a sustained period. It's not just a moment. But then, after 1976, a further fall in the TFR, it's up, off that graph really, but to just below or just on replacement levels at the moment. Britain today does not have one of the lowest fertilities in the world. That tends to be the Far East Asian countries and southern Mediterranean countries, which are well below replacement. But it does have pretty low fertility, not drastically low, but relatively low fertility at the moment, and has had for about the last 25 years or so. So I'm going to go through these different phases with you and suggest that at least in some of them, in fact many of them, collective provision, this long-standing welfare system that we've had, has been really quite important in helping us to explain some of these big ups and downs and movements in the TFR, the total fertility rate. So the first phase, phases 1 and 2, so that's the decline from 1540 to 1660, and then the long secular rise from 1660 to 1820. We've got the best work that's been done on this is by the Cambridge Group, the work of Wrigley and Schofield and their various associates, where they have argued that really what we're seeing really quite strongly in this period is the importance of the trends in the real wage rate of the majority of the population, because that's what is quite strongly associated with a decision of young people whether or not to get married in this system. When you get a period of the wage rate falling, as you can see in that graph there, from the 1650s, 40s through to the 1540s down to a nadir in the 1630s, the real wage trend leads by about a 10 or 20 year period a concomitant fall in the TFR, which is primarily being driven by increasing proportions of the young marriageable cohorts failing to enter marriage. So at the beginning of that period, back in the early 16th century, mid 16th century, perhaps only 10 or 15% of young people failed to get married during their reproducing years. By the end of that period, with real wages having gone down so much, you're up to 20, even 25% of the cohort failing to enter marriage. and that is going to reduce fertility quite significantly. Conversely, the long rise upwards from that nadir is a period of rising real wages, and the opposite effect, more and more youngsters entering marriage, so that by the time we get to the early to mid 18th century, even as almost as many as 90% of every young cohort is actually finding that they can afford to get married. They enter marriage, and of course that boosts the fertility of the nation. So the dominant driver in that period, a dominant driver, is real wages. But there is also a new fertility factor producing that really extra steep peak, that kind of mountain at the top in the second half of the 18th century is being driven by more than just more people entering marriage. There's no real increase from the 1730s onwards. Britain hits about 90% of the cohort marrying at that point, and it doesn't rise very much more, but fertility is still rising over the next half century to a real peak. And what's going on there, according to the demographic historians, is a new development that people are not only have you now got a kind of maximum number entering marriage, 90 to 92.3% of the cohort, but they're actually marrying earlier. They're marrying in their early 20s instead of their mid 20s, and for men similarly. Both sexes marry in England at similar ages at this time. They're actually using a further 2 to 3 years of their fecundity, whereas previously they waited until 26 women, now they're marrying at 23. That means more fertility. And this is a new development, that actually people are marrying even younger than they ever previously did. Something very, apparently very good opportunities in the economy. So there are a number of really quite interesting theories that have been developed over the years. A lot of good and interesting research has gone into this, specifically really explaining that extra surge, that sort of enormous sort of super dose of fertility that we're seeing in the second half of the 18th and into the early 19th century. Probably one of the, in a way, I'm, you know, to give the game away, I think none of these are all right. All of these theories are right to some extent. It's not that one's right and the others are wrong. They are all actually providing us with very helpful components of the explanation. So Anne Cusmall and Keith Snell, back in the early 80s, pointed to the decline of live-in farm service, which had been a very widespread practice in the British economy, part of the way in which this society sustained what's been called, in comparative terms, late marriage. The fact that so many youngsters were marrying as late as their mid to late 20s, when one looks comparatively across the world to many other cultures and societies, this is late marriage, is that there was a viable place for youngsters to live out their late teenage and their early adulthood, which was in the form of farm service and, for some of them, apprenticeship in trades like blacksmithing and so on. So young adults would leave the home that they'd been born in at about the age of 15, maybe even a little bit younger, and they would spend the next 10 years of their life living relatively independently, earning modest wages and building up skills, life skills, and working in and around farm service, most of them, and some of them in towns. But in the course of the second half of the 18th century, because of farmers' inclination with following market opportunities of rising populations in the town to start raising the productivity of their farm units, they're moving towards labour practices that involve more wage labour, day and weekly hiring of wage labour, and less inclination to employ large numbers of young people and hold them on these were yearly contracts. The young people entering service went into yearly contracts. They got modest wages, but they got their food and board and lodging provided for the whole year and then at the end of the year they would decide, am I going to get married now or am I going to go in for another year of service? But that practice is in the decline, particularly in the south and east of England, not quite so much in the north of the Midlands, but it's going into decline. So that, in a sense, is causing female unemployment, which Snell's book is documenting. And in a sense, young women are now finding they haven't actually got anywhere to go except into marriage. They're kind of being driven into marriage because there isn't this opportunity to enter service. And their own parents, their own households are perhaps no better off. So they're not able to hold them at home anymore. So that's one kind of an explanation, one driver suggesting why there would be pressure towards more universal and earlier marriage. On its own, it's not a very convincing explanation, but we need some of these other things that we're going to talk about to make it work. Proto-industrialization was the thesis of David Levine and others. It was, in its original form, a very ambitious theory purporting to explain the whole of the Industrial Revolution. Economic historians of Britain don't view it in that way anymore. They don't believe it works as a generalisation. But it's probably still quite a helpful part of this particular story. And it's about those parts of the country that did have proto-industry, which might be more familiarly known as cottage industry or domestic manufacturing. The argument is that there was a tendency in this system, and this tendency is expressed in the course of the second half of the 18th and early 19th century, for self-exploitation, that workers living in hamlets producing nails or producing bits of cloth or producing stockings for a middleman. The middleman is trying to boost his profits. The most obvious way to do this, in of course he's competing with others like him, that's why he needs to do this, is to drive down the unit price he's paying, this working unit for him. As he does that, the proto-industrialization thesis argument is that the proto-industrial family responds to a cut in the price of its unit of output by self-exploiting itself and working harder, producing more output to maintain the same income. And the interesting argument there is that, which Levine has documented for some proto-industrial villages, is that one of the ways in which they can work harder is actually by having more children in the household, because these households are using child labour as part of their workforce. So that's the proto-industrialisation argument. It works quite, it seems to have plausibility. Its weakness, of course, is that only certain parts of the country are proto-industrial, probably no more than 10 or 15% of the workforce at most. But we're seeing a fertility fall driven by falling marriage age all over the country. So this cannot be a complete explanation, even if it helps us explain what's going on in those sorts of places. Thirdly, we have the proletarianization thesis of Jack Goldstone, which I think is a kind of classic article that came out in 1986. I think it was in Population Studies originally. It's been reproduced very often. It's a very dense and rewarding article with all sorts of aspects to it. One of his key arguments was that when it came out in 1986 was that we tend to associate the word proletarian with industrial urban workers, after following Marx's famous use of the term. But what proletarianization is actually about is about the wage labour form, is about workers having to work for wages, having no property, existing in most extremes from day to day, but more typically perhaps week to week with their wages. And his argument is that, and it's the kind of, it goes along with that first thesis about the decline of farm service, that the agricultural workforce of the country, particularly in the south and the east, is becoming proletarianized in this period. It's moving towards wage labor as its form of away from the service type contracts. More and more workers are being hired by the week or even by the day for wage labor. And his argument in relation to fertility is that previously, these young adults had all patiently waited through their adolescence into their 20s, accumulating small amounts of earnings and experience in order, in their mid to late 20s, to get married. And he calls that the accumulation model of marriage, or what Malthus would have called the prudential marriage model. His argument is that what proletarianization does is it produces a new model of marriage, which he coined a very ugly phrase, the future earnings prospect model of marriage. What he means by this is he says that what's happening with proletarianization is that young people, particularly men, as Snell shows us, are getting access to daily and weekly wage rates, which are fantastic compared to what they would have got as domestic servants. They're several times greater when they're working for mill owners and so on. These are good wages. These are wages. Why not get married? Look at the money I'm earning. He also argues, and I think this is the weak point of his argument, that not only are proletarianized workers getting higher wages at earlier in their lives than ever before, but they have a prospect that this is going to continue. So they have no insecurity about getting married. They've got high wages. Labour markets are booming. Why not get married? And there are all these unemployed women who can't do domestic service anymore who are also saying, yeah, why not get married? Let's get married. So those are the three kind of economics-related arguments about why we're seeing this super surge of extra fertility driven by a new practice of very, very low marriage ages by historic English standards. And then finally, I think there's the one that's particularly relevant to what I'm talking about today, the institutionalist argument that the poor laws are a crucial part of this story as well. Because that weakness in the Goldstone argument is a powerful one. It applies to potentially rather more of the workforce than the proto-industrialization thesis does. And it seems to it has a nice kind of linkage with the domestic service one as well. It's the other side of it. But it does have this sort of stretch of the imagination that these young workers have a sense of security in this high wage economy. We all know that mill towns, particularly by the 1770s, 80s, 90s, were quite insecure places to earn a living. There was the trade cycle was beginning to emerge. People would get laid off and taken on, and so on. However, if you are living in a society that has a social security system in place, the poor laws, and if that system is functioning well, then that is providing a floor underneath you, whereby you can say, well, I'm earning good wages, and anyway, and if I do get made unemployed, well, there's always the dole. There's always, it's not ideal, but my kids aren't going to starve if I have two or three children, and then I'll get, and then the wages will start up again. So I think Roger Schofield, who was my PhD supervisor, in fact, who first put forward this argument, is I think a crucial. I think without his argument about the importance of the institutional poor laws, these other three don't really quite add up. They don't really make a convincing explanation. So what were these poor laws? I said I'd talk a little bit about it because I think they're fascinating, very important, and I don't think enough people really understand what they did for this society, for this country, for so long. The founding statutes of the poor law, 1598 and 1601, at the end of the reign of Elizabeth I. Those statutes followed 60 or 70 years of experimentation. They are the culmination of a large number of statutes trying to get the system right. And these ones really lasted because they, after all that experimentation, they felt they'd put something in place that worked. What were they? Well, they have a number of important features which I think qualify them for being understood as something very much like what we understand a welfare state to be, certainly functionally. They are premised on a universal legal right to relief for every subject. There's a new book came out two or three years ago by Laurie Charlesworth, which was important for pointing out that this really was a legal right to relief. It wasn't a convention, it wasn't a custom, it is a legal right that can be defended. in law in front of the Justice of the Peace. Every one of England's 10,000 or more parishes are mandated to create a parish fund. You can't not do this. That parish fund, very interesting, is financed by progressive taxation because it's a pro rata tax on property value. Highly progressive tax system. It is to support the local poor all the year round, if necessary. This is not just famine relief. This is not just a matter of dearth. It's there as support all the year round. And it's for orphans, for widows, the old, the disabled, the unemployed. These are all covered explicitly in the Acts. This is laid out very clearly. Its strengths are that it's universalist, but it's highly devolved. Its administration is devolved to the parish level. And parishes are not large units at this time. I think with 10,000 parishes, you've got about 500 or 600 people in the average parish. So there's good information. The officers of the poor law who are administering this system, probably know damn well who is supposed to be paying in and who are the big houses and who the estates are, and they know pretty well who's the needs of those who are taking out, and it's probably not that easy to hoodwink them. It's got potential weaknesses, notably local corruption. If officials are unpleasant individuals or corrupt, unfortunate things can obviously happen. There is the possibility of free riding of one parish trying, and this certainly, as far as I read the historian's work on this, a parish trying to sort of set a rather low rate in the hope that the poor will go somewhere else and sort of free ride on other parishes around them. And the Privy Council was something that tried to police that in the early years to stop. Some parishes tried to refuse to set a rate, but we have evidence that that was not a strategy that worked or was accepted. And the other possibility is the converse, is unlimited liability. The problem of parishes thinking, well, hang on a minute, if we have a parish fund here, what's going to stop everybody coming here and saying, I've got a universal right to relief, you've got to relieve me. So there are certain problems, and the system takes 50, 60 years of teething to sort these problems out. The solutions to the potential problems are that justices of the peace are overseeing the system, and they're very interesting because they must live locally, they must be resident in the community, but they owe their place to the pleasure of the crown. So they're not in the pocket of the local elite. Their duty is to the crown, and their activities are reviewed by higher judges. Exclusion of free riding by the Privy Council, which takes a dim view of parishes that are trying to free ride. And then the crucial final thing is the settlement laws, which particularly the 1662 law, which is laws which define liability of parishes. They define, because every subject has an absolute right to relief, these are rules about where your relief is. And the basic rule is you have a right to relief in one parish only. And there are certain rules about it. The default is where you are born. But for a woman, very importantly, once you marry, your settlement moves to the parish of your husband. It doesn't remain in the parish of your birth. And there are very important rules about migration, about people moving to another parish, taking up work, how long they have to stay in that parish before they can establish a right of relief in that parish, rather than having to be taken back to the one they originate from. But a crucial feature of this of the poor law, unlike the American variants which were developed in New England, is that the parish authorities, it falls to them, if they are not going to support somebody who comes to them for relief, and if the Justice of the Peace agrees that this person deserves relief, if they say this is not one of ours, they have to bear the costs of taking that person to the parish of that they're claiming he should be relieved in. So you can't, in the English system, you cannot simply wash your hands of someone who comes to relief and say, you're not one of ours, bugger off. You've got to actually take them to, whereas in New England, they had a practice called warning out, which was exactly that, that people were sort of excluded from the parish. So the old poor law, the Elizabethan poor law, is probably in its maturity between about 1660 and 1834, and I would see it as four interlocking institutions of local governance mandated by central government, consisting of the poor laws, the justices of the peace, the settlement laws, and parish registers are very important. I'm not going to go into that, it's something I've written about a lot, but the parish registers established before the poor law turn out to be quite a useful way of avoiding masses of litigation about who has a right where, because they record where you're born and they record where you marry, and so a lot of those kinds of problems actually get solved by the existence of parish registers. And furthermore, there's an enormous incentive for the poor, the propertyless poor, to have their children christened and registered, to have their marriages registered, rather than just to say, what's all this to do with me, all this writing down on paper, you know, a birth happening, because that carries an entitlement, a very valuable entitlement, your right to relief. And that's, I think, why the Cambridge group has benefited from this, because that's why the registers were kept so well and why they've discovered that they can do such interesting demographic work with them. So, this is just a general, you know, there are questions about, so we've talked about what was the poor law, what, how did it function. There are issues about, you know, well, okay, it looks good on paper, but, you know, did it really exist? I mean, what you know, how important was it? And these are statistics about the actual amounts of money going in transfers through the poor law. And these are very, very high figures for any kind of early modern society. They're not large by our standards today. But what that's showing you is between 1 and 2% of GDP is being transferred to the poor through this system at parish level. Very, very large amount of wealth of the nation's income is supporting the poor. We have other evidence, that's from general sort of statistics, of various bits of evidence that Richard Smith has put together in a chapter in a book I edited, where you can actually estimate how much money is in the Board of Trade returns, a parliamentary inquiry in 1783 and another one in 1802, showing us that, yes, corroborating that graph I've just shown you, that the amounts of money in this system are sufficient for 10% of the population to be relieved for a year. So these are other forms of evidence confirming that the system is a big system. It's not just a piece of paper. It's not just a good idea. It was really functioning in practice on a very big scale. Peter Solar has written, I think, a really very important article in the Economic History Review back in 1995, in which he took a comparative perspective across Europe. Because what he said in 1995 was that English historians of the poor law have sort of gone into it, they've found that it's there, they've recognised it and so on, but they're kind of very preoccupied with all the iniquities in it, all the nastiness in it, the poor law overseers who wouldn't give something to somebody, others who were in... You know, social control was the kind of the dominant way of looking at the old poor law. And I think he liberated, I mean, of course, all of those things happened, and the poor law had a class aspect to it, if you like, which wasn't necessarily wonderful. But what he said was, if you look at this thing that England has, the poor law, in comparative perspective, it's absolutely incredible. There is nothing like this. The thing that is so unique about it, Peter Solar tells us, is that poor laws in other parts of Europe only ever exist in cities and towns where the governing class is worried about riot in times of high prices. The really unusual thing about the English poor law is it's there in every parish all around the country, so that when there is time of hardship, the rural starving poor don't come with their diseases crowding into the towns looking for support. They stay where they are because the relief is there for them. And these are a couple of other important books that have been published sort of documenting the existence of the poor law. And then we have a kind of bottom line, very important, again, using the comparative perspective, very important, significant bottom line finding confirming both the existence of the poor law and its value to the nation's poor, which is that the Cambridge Group's studies show that, you remember earlier I showed you a graph about the way in which marriage rates, fertility and marriage rates, in fact, are responsive to the price of wheat, the real wage, in effect. That real wage graph is really telling you how the price of wheat is moving up and down. In most of Western Europe, death rates are responsive to the price of wheat throughout the early modern period. But uniquely in England, there is no national famine crisis after 1623-4. That is the last time in England there is a national scale death rate peak that you can find in the registers, in the death registers that Cambridge Group have analysed, which is clearly triggered by a famine, prices of food. Now that is a freedom from food insecurity in England 150 years earlier than anywhere else in Western Europe, and it's an extraordinary achievement of the poor law for all its warts and social control aspects and so on. It is actually delivering an extraordinary sort of form of security to the English population. But, of course, all good things come to an end. Classical political economy, particularly in the form of Adam Smith, was opposed to the poor laws as a distorting mechanism, something that messed up labour prices and incentives in the marketplace. He was also very concerned, completely wrongly. Adam Smith spent most of his time in Scotland. He probably should have got out a bit more. He wrongly thought that the settlement laws and the English poor laws acted as an impediment against migration, which he thought was a very bad idea, and it would have been a bad idea if they had. But all the evidence we have shows that the English population is about the most mobile population documented in history, both short-term and long-term mobility. The fact that Britain's rate of urbanisation is faster than anywhere else in Western Europe across the two centuries in which the poor law functions is testimony to the fact that there is no way that the poor law was impeding labour mobility, as Adam Smith alleged. Malthus famously thought that the poor law was an inducement to improvident behaviour by the poor. He thought it was, and you know, Roger Scofield is in a sense confirming that he was right in a way, that it was encouraging people to marry early. It was encouraging this fast rising birth rate. Malthus, of course, as Tony Wrigley has very persuasively argued, and all of the classical economists, for all of their genius, their brilliance, their analytical acumen, they just couldn't possibly have seen what the steam engine was about to do in terms of the energy releases, changing long-term relationships between population and the economy, so that this release of fertility, this low marriage that Malthus was so concerned about, actually proved never to be the problem that he anticipated. Malthus himself, as Wrigley has pointed out, was actually more ambivalent about the poor law than he's been given credit for. He went to Norway in the 1800s and saw severe famine there, and he came back and there's a statement by Malthus in which he says, actually, I think the poor law is not such a bad idea after all. I just wish it didn't lead to improvident marriage, which he was really concerned about. So what we get is, as a result of the adoption of the ideas of political economy, classical political economy, eventually in the 1820s and 30s, there are attempts to clamp down on the poor law, to reduce it. And in 1834, in the 1820s, you can see expenditure per capita. This is expenditure per capita on the poor law. You can see it rising all the way through the second half of the 18th century, then dropping quite significantly across the 1820s and 30s, when the final cut in 1834 with the poor law, reducing expenditure enormously. So I think that's what's going on with that first initial drop in the fertility from that peak from 1821 through to 1851, is the poor law is being tightened. It's then actually being reformed and cut. That's a period in which poor law expenditure is falling. So poor people are actually starting to say, oh, actually, this is not such a great idea after all, this early marriage, because the poor law isn't quite as reliable. And after 1834, it really isn't as reliable. It's become quite draconian. You have to go into a workhouse if you're going to, supposedly, not many places resisted that for a while. Then I think that what you get is through the rest of the 19th century, you get the poor law cut right back to a rather modest level of expenditure. The government never manages to really get poor law expenditure down as much as they want to, but they hold it at a really rather low level, and they use this deterrent of the workhouse. They say in order to qualify, you've got to go into the workhouse, which sort of feels like being imprisoned for those who go in. And so the English working classes in this period may be experiencing some increasing real wages whilst when they're in work, but they are probably experiencing a lot of insecurity because the poor law is no longer really your friend. So you're really quite concerned about security of income of your family. And this period is associated with this period of chronic insecurity of income, analysed by Seebohm Rowntree in the 1890s, resulting in what he called life cycle poverty, very much related to childbearing. If you're in the working classes in the second half of the 19th century with this new poor law in place, it quite clearly the more children you have, the more likely you're going to dip down below the poverty line, because you're going to get to a point where your earnings are not able to match your outgoings, and you have a rather unfriendly social security system now. It doesn't disappear, but it's a deliberately deterrent system. So I think this is associated with this very strong, marked declining TFR, which of course is associated with something new, novel, that I've spent a lot of time researching, and many other historians are very interested in as well, because it's a kind of intriguing problem to try and explain that certain sections of the population, but by the time we get to the First World War, practically everybody apart from coal mining communities is now beginning to do something novel, which is control fertility in marriage. Instead of only controlling fertility by virtue of when you start marriage, they're now doing something additional, which is actually spacing out their children or abstaining or in some way getting hold of early forms of birth control and restricting fertility in marriage, restricting it quite dramatically. And that's driving the total fertility rate right down in these difficult times. The difficult times do start to alleviate. You get the beginnings just before the First World War, new liberal thinking of more progressive social legislation, famously pensions for the poor. Rowntree and others go into the workhouses in the 1890s and discover that the only people in the workhouses by then are not these work-shy adults, they're just old people who are clapped out, who just can't work anymore, and they're saying, is this really the way to treat our old people? So old age pensions in 1908 is the beginnings of changing that thinking about the poor law, beginning to move back to something different. National Insurance Acts for workers in 1911, and of course as back to that big bulge later in the 40s is actually to do that Second World War expenditure, of course, because this is undisaggregated expenditure. But you can see the general point is very strong rising public expenditure across the 20th century, particularly after the Second World War, when of course we get back to the more familiar welfare state, the one we know about, the Beveridge designed one, which of course is all about social insurances and the NHS, and also equally important, full employment within a Keynesian framework of thinking, that guaranteeing people security of income as well as providing them with all these services. As you know, the welfare state has benefits in kind: national health service, education, public housing. It has various other contributory benefits and so on. It's a big system that's created within it. We rightly make a big fuss about the post Second World War welfare state. It's clearly on a much grander scale than anything that's been done before, but in principle it's a return to that system that was there for 250 years before 1834. It's more lavish, it's more appropriate for a human capital society, and it's very explicit that it's about avoiding unemployment as much as anything else. Now, if you've got a, if you are living in a country with a with a government committed to make sure you are in a job, then not surprisingly, you get if not only the government is committed, but at least until the 1970s, it actually delivers as well. Unemployment is fantastically low for the first 25 years after the Second World War. As you can see there, unemployment just hundreds of thousands, low hundreds of thousands. Even in the famous 1970s, the disaster decade, supposedly it still never rises above a million in that decade. It's only the multi-million unemployment is a phenomenon of the last 25 to 30 years. So what I'm saying is that I don't want to go right back to the beginning, I should have put it in again, that baby boom at the end of the TFR that you saw, that significant baby boom is no mystery if you've finally got back to a society that's endowing itself with a generous welfare state, with a commitment to full employment, with actual full employment. It's the same as it was back in the late 18th century, that if people have got good employment prospects and they've got a state that's underwriting it when you have hard times, people will get married, people will have children, people will bring up their births. As we now reduce that and pull it away in the last 30 years, people are wondering, why are we getting such a low birth rate again? Why are we back to TFRs of only 1.6, 1.7? I'd say this is no mystery at all. If we're living in a society with really quite large amounts of unemployment, difficulties with inflation as well at some times, then people are going to be very concerned about having children. We're not any longer too worried about getting married or not, because cohabitation is an acceptable option, but starting a family, increasing a family, is something that people are going to quite rightly be worried about in these sort of circumstances. So, conclusion, policy, because history and policy always want some conclusions or thoughts about policy. Demography and the welfare state over the long term, some general conclusions. So this exceptionally pervasive long-term history of a universal welfare state, in these circumstances, demography in England and Wales has been sensitive to major changes in welfare ideology and policy for four centuries, not just today, not just the last several decades. This sensitivity is expressed not only in trends in health and mortality, which are probably slightly better known and better appreciated, but even more directly, I would argue, in turning points in fertility, these big turning points that we've looked at. Decisions of young adults about entry into marriage before 1870 and about the fertility of their marriage after 1870 reflect an interplay of their perceptions about desired living standards and their perceptions of the risks to the family's future security of income. Both of these are in turn influenced by changes in sources of secure employment and in welfare policy. Okay, thank you.